So it's a real pleasure to introduce again Dr. Trevor Stammers. And what's organ donation euthanasia all about? Well, in every country that has legalized euthanasia, organ donation following euthanasia has also been legalized eventually. In Canada, organ removal was integrated to the euthanasia practice right from the very start. And the utilitarian case for it is, as some say, overwhelmingly logical. If it's ethical to allow doctors to end a patient's life to relieve their suffering, then giving the patient the opportunity to save other lives through donating their organs would seem to naturally follow. And so this seminar is going to explore how organ donation euthanasia has grown, especially in Belgium and Canada, consider the arguments put forward for it, and also offer then a biblical Christian response. Dr. Trevor Stammers is well known on ICMDA webinars. He was editor of the New Bioethics Journal, and he was also formerly associate professor of bioethics and medical law at St. Mary's University. And prior to that, he was a family doctor for 27 years before going into academia. So he's coming both with a wealth of clinical experience and also academic experience. His latest book is on the ethics of global organ acquisition, and he's done a couple of other webinars that you can search for on the database on issues around organ transplantation. So, and he's also a very dear friend going back over nearly 40 years. So, Trevor, it's just such a pleasure to have you back here again to address this intriguing but vexed topic, and we really look forward to hearing what you have to say. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for that introduction, Peter. It's a joy to be back with you, though not sure that it's a joy to be talking about a subject that I find remarkably difficult to talk about because I find it hard to see how our medical systems have got into a situation where we are doing this practice, but we are there, and so we need to look at it, try to understand it, and see what a Christian response to it might be. Well, I'm going to say right from the start that I am very pro organ donation on as a whole, and that's one of the reasons why I've written my most recent book on the ethics of it. I want to start off just by asking all of you a question, and that is, what do you think is the key ethical element for voluntary organ donation to function might be? Informed consent, yes. Yes, altruism. Yes, that's all good. Autonomy. Yeah, all of these things are very, very important. But I think all of them become either irrelevant or undermined if something else, even more fundamental, is not present. Though they're all related to issues like consent and the exercise of autonomy. The key thing to my reckoning is that of public trust. And once that has gone, the whole enterprise of organ donation is under threat. And that's why, in the beginning of the book, in the first chapter, I've written about three cases in different countries that caused the organ donation systems in their respective countries to stall for years, and in the case of Japan, for decades. The first of those in Singapore was triggered when a hard opt-out meant that security guards had to be called to a ward to drag the grieving relatives off the ventilated body of their relative for him to be wheeled away, for the organs to be removed, with the relatives pleading that they had more time to come to terms with his demise. The Wada case in Japan was one where a heart surgeon, after the first heart transplant to take place in Japan, I think it was, had possibly operated on somebody who didn't need a heart transplant and was also caring for the donor or had links with the donor as well. And that stopped all heart transplantation in Japan for a couple of decades, I think. That was a really big shock to the system there. And Eamon O was a transplant surgeon who fabricated the details and documents of overseas recipients pretending that they were living in Germany in order to provide them with transplants. And I fear that the next big shock to the whole of the transplantation system is going to come through the medium of organ donation, euthanasia. And particularly in those countries where it is beginning to skyrocket, sooner or later, there is going to be some kind of scandal developing. So that's one reason why I think it's important, even if in your own countries, euthanasia and so-called assisted dying have not yet been introduced. Now, that leads me to the first subject of the vexed question of terminology, where in this world, sometimes words just mean what the usually advocates of a practice want it to mean. And medical assistance in dying, the wonderful acronym of MAID, a lovely sort of positive word, isn't it? The MAID comes to make your room tidy and make the bed comfortable and so on. And yet this MAID comes to administer death. And that's short for medically assisted dying, or suicide, as I still awkwardly insist on in calling it. Is essentially the provision of a prescription of a lethal dose of drugs for the patient to take them to end their lives at the time they choose. And voluntary euthanasia is the administration of the lethal dose by a healthcare professional. And it's interesting that in Canada, particularly, a fair proportion of the cases now are not being administered by a doctor, but by a specialist nurse. And I think that practice is also going to continue, but by a healthcare professional anyway, to a patient at the patient's request. But really, and there's always a but, in my view, medical assistance in dying or assisted dying or assisted suicide and euthanasia are completely inseparable in practice, whether or not in law a country has introduced both at once, as in the case of Canada, for example. Because wherever assisted dying is introduced, if you're giving lethal prescriptions to patients, some cases are going to be too ill to take them without help. And another issue is that also, of course, for some patients who do manage to take it themselves, it may not necessarily kill them. And if you look at the cases in Oregon, for example, there's one case where somebody woke up a couple of days after taking the lethal medication. And interestingly, he went on to have a natural death thereafter and decided not to not to try it twice. So that's one problem. But the other thing is that in those countries like Canada and now Australia, where you've introduced or legalized both at once, that's euthanasia or the option to take the prescription yourself, the vast majority of people actually request euthanasia. And in the latest reports from Canada, with 13,000 recorded medically assisted deaths, there were fewer, and this is in the actual report, it's worded as there were fewer than 7 deaths from self-administration. And in Australia, which is only just started down this road, but the vast majority of the cases are where the doctor is giving the lethal injection, and this is at patient request. So this is a side comment, but it seems to me that patients are not just requesting autonomy in their death, but they are requesting a doctor's blessing and a medical sanction of their passing. And it seems to me that doctors do function some kind of semi-priestly role in their dispatching patients in this way. Plus, I suspect, a natural disinclination to taking one's own life by one's own hand. You do have to be very, very motivated to do that, but perhaps not quite so motivated for your general practitioner or a doctor that you know or don't know to do it as part of a medical service. Now, once you have introduced it, then, as Peter indicated in his introduction, those also advocating organ donation and euthanasia, I think nearly all of the bioethicists say that this should be one of the most convincing reasons why we should accept euthanasia, because for a patient to choose to die and give the opportunity of life to up to 9 other people, then that is, from a utilitarian point of view, an absolutely overwhelming reason to allow it, if the maximum benefit for the maximum number of people governs your ethics. So organ donation and euthanasia now are inextricably intertwined in those countries allowing euthanasia. And as with MAID and euthanasia, the terminology used for it is also becoming very confused and muddled. And I think this is probably deliberate, because if people are not sure what they're talking about, then it's much more difficult to criticize it. And you can use the terminology that makes it sound the most benign. And certainly organ donation, euthanasia, ODE, is the most frequently used term. And when it started to be used, it was used to refer to organ donation following after euthanasia. But in some very recent papers, ODE has been used to describe euthanasia by organ donation, which in other papers is referred to as ERVO, euthanasia by removal of vital organs, the abbreviation at the bottom. So in my own writing, when I'm talking about organ donation following euthanasia, I usually put an F in it, and that's what I've done consistently in my book, essentially to distinguish it from ERVO, which I'll talk about towards the end. Now, I hope that's clear, or if it's not clear yet, it will become clear as I talk about these two very separate issues. And I'm going to start off by talking about organ donation following euthanasia. And everybody's a winner with that. In this case, the rather ironic title that's been given to a paper advocating it when it was discussed in BioEdge, which for those of you who know that newsletter, you won't be surprised that it was actually quite critical of the process. But this is where somebody who is able medically to donate organs, should they choose to have their life terminated, can also choose to donate their organs following their death by a lethal injection by a doctor. And the reason that it's a winner in many bioethicists' eyes are the benefits to the donor, that there's full autonomy expressed, and it's a altruistic, beneficent act in its own right, which can increase the self-worth of the patient. And we'll see an interesting real-life account from a patient towards the end in Canada in connection with that. And then there are real benefits for the recipient. And I have to say that if I were ever in need of an organ and I didn't have a compatible identical twin, which I don't, and a living donor couldn't be found who matched, the next best organ to have by a mile is an organ from somebody who has been euthanized for the reasons outlined here. The ischemic time, the time that an organ is without oxygen between being taken out and transferred into you, can be kept to a minimum, and the outcomes of the process are excellent. And of course, there are other knock-on effects for others with reduced waiting lists. So it's a win-win situation from a utilitarian point of view and from a clinical point of view as well. So much so that when Belgium introduced it, and we'll see some of the Belgian figures in a moment or two, for a year or two, they even altered the Maastricht classification of donation after circulatory death to have a category five, which was euthanasia death, because these organs were having even better results than cardiac arrest after brainstem death, the best category of controlled circulatory death. But after a while, that suddenly, as a separate categorization, died a death of its own. And I'm not sure of the reasons for that, but perhaps it made it a little too easy to possibly identify these deaths. I'm only speculating. I don't quite know why they stopped doing it. But it is interesting that the advantages were such that they even added a different classification. Belgium was the second country after the Netherlands to introduce euthanasia in 2002. And it was only a few years, 5 or 6 years after that, that organ donation became available after euthanasia. And a slight overlap with the previous slides there, but the second point here, that it's the only form of deceased donation, if it is deceased donation, and I'll come to the question mark over that a bit later. So the only form of deceased donation where the timing of the death of the donor can be optimized for the recipient's benefit. And obviously, if you have, say, a physically fit young man with severe depression who has autonomously decided that he would rather be dead, then there is no particular time pressure necessarily, if he wants to also donate his organs, to wait until you have a donor, a recipient, sorry, ready in the operating theatre next door, if the patient also agrees with that. So you can see why it can be a win-win situation if organ optimization is your only key thing that you're looking at. And the outcomes, as you see from this results here, these were of lung donations, the for Detri's case study, I think, of 100% survival at 3 years. And at that time in Belgium, almost a quarter of lung donations were from euthanasia cases. The actual total numbers were very small, but a significant proportion. And the optimal candidates are obviously going to be those dying in hospital rather than at home, although I'll return to them in a minute. But interestingly, it's going to be younger patients, as I've mentioned, and particularly adolescents and children, and those with psychological disorders rather than physical disorders, because they're much less likely to have any contraindicated medical conditions. And Canada is set, unless there is another delay, to introduce euthanasia for psychological disorders from March, so only a couple of months to go this year. And if they do so, I'm quite sure the numbers of organ donations from euthanasia cases will rocket there even further than they are at the moment. Prisoners are another potential category that I just list there, but there are other issues relating to prisoners that I haven't got time to go in this study. But also because most euthanasia cases like to receive it in their own home, there are a number of papers out there now illustrating how practically you can sedate the patient in their own home and then transport them to hospital and have the organs removed once they've got into hospital. So it's no longer a barrier. Slightly worrying aspect of this paper is that the patients were sedated, if I remember correctly, with midazolam, but it was described as giving them anesthesia. Now, I'm no pharmacologist and I'm no anaesthetist, but it certainly struck somebody as being a significant enough error for somebody who is in favor of organ donation euthanasia to point out that giving midazolam is not anesthesia, and they hope that something else was administered as well. So a rather worrying issue there. But a much more worrying issue was illustrated in this paper by Raphael Cohen-Almagor, who is himself in favor of the introduction of assisted dying in Britain, but still very concerned that, as you see there, patients might be motivated to consider euthanasia for the purpose of organ procurement. And people with depression may, and indeed, as we shall see, are particularly vulnerable in that regard. And this is a detailed paper, a detailed pictorial representation of a paper from the Netherlands about a series of patients with psychiatric illness who donated their organs afterwards. And I'm going to go quickly to a diagrammatic representation of that, to just show you the key point there, that of all euthanasia cases, and this is taken from a presentation by Dr. Mark Conrad in the United States, who's a great opponent of introducing assisted dying for psychiatric patients. And he points out that cases of psychiatric illness in the left-hand circle constitute only 1% of all euthanasia cases in that series, but they constituted 29% of all of the organ donations. So proportionately, as you'd expect, the mentally unwell are going to be contributing much more to the practice. Now, this is a chilling quote from 2012 from a paper in Bioethics, then moving a step further, which we're on the threshold or may have crossed the threshold of since 2012. Why should surgeons have to wait until the patient's actually died? An alternative would be to anaesthetize the patient and remove the organs, including the heart and lungs. Brain death would then follow. Yes, it would follow removal of the heart. And you see, they call this organ donation euthanasia, which is usually used to describe what I've previously outlined to you. So I call this, as at the top there, euthanasia by removal of vital organs. And there's been a recent call from two of the key advocates of this, Jan Boll and David Shaw and their colleagues. And in calling for it to be legalized, they had this paragraph, which I must confess, I boggle at how they let it pass. Regardless of a possible change in the law, it's crucial to avoid the general public is given the impression that there is a hunt for organs to take vital organs from a living patient. Well, you can be very sure it's crucial to avoid giving that general impression, but that doesn't deny that that's what it is. Killing patients by removing their organs. Now, briefly, to just see how this has astronomically increased in Canada, which now has by far and away the most organ donations from euthanasia in terms of absolute numbers of patients. And it's happened very swiftly. The legislation was done in conjunction with being able to do organ donations. So it happened within the first year after legalization. And you can see here how the numbers have just shot up in terms of the numbers of people being euthanized in Canada, 13,000, more than 13,000 in the last year of which we have records. And equally, the numbers of organs being transplanted. Now this is a series across countries, but you can see that in 2017, when Canada started doing it, that's when the numbers globally started to shoot up. And with the exception of 2020, when the pandemic curtailed it a bit, they've continued to shoot up. And I think this will continue to escalate. And yet, only a half of those in with depression in this paper received even minimally adequate counseling or psychotherapy or minimally adequate antidepressant therapy. Now, how can it be in a country that is so efficient at garnering organs, only half of those with depression in this one sequence obviously are receiving treatment? This should be ringing alarm bells, surely, on a wide scale. And I mentioned that there would be personal testimony of a patient. I find this absolutely chilling. This again is one of Dr. Conrad's slides. I thought the knowledge of having full autonomy by way of my medically assisted death was comforting, but the possibility of organ donation being added to it, the sense of elation, is the only appropriate word for me. Now, in coming into land, what's the biblical principles perhaps to respond to this? Well, firstly, of course, part of the Ten Commandments is that you shall not murder. And of course, people in favor of it will say, well, euthanasia is not murder. This is at the patient's request. Well, even our NHS website says that depending on the circumstances, euthanasia is regarded as either manslaughter or murder, for which rightly there is a penalty of life imprisonment. And once the patient is dead, they clearly can't be questioned about whether they requested it, what the motivation was, and so on. And I think we do need to continually remind ourselves where, you know, autonomy is being touted, that you can't check on autonomy once the person has gone. And detecting murder in a society that legalizes euthanasia is far more difficult. And there are a couple of examples of assisted suicide, or what approximates to it, in the scriptures, the death of Saul and the death of Abimelech in those scriptures there. Two men who had forsaken the ways of the Lord and had died in a way that I think is not one that the writer of the scriptures and the God who inspired it is approving of in those particular stories. We might discuss that further. But the key principle of the New Testament in regard to organ donation, euthanasia, seems to me to be this one. St. Paul says, why not say, let us do evil so that good may come, just as we are being slandered, and as some claim that we say, and their condemnation is deserved. So let us do evil that good may come. The fact that lives can be saved from this, when it is an evil procedure in the first case, does not justify it, and condemnation, I think, should still be there. And I finish with this slide. It seems to me that greater love has no one than this, that they should lay down their lives for their friends, is one of the most powerful sayings of our Lord to justify the principle of organ donation, both living and deceased. That with living donation, hopefully you do not lay down your life, but you do put your life at risk for your friends. But in organ donation euthanasia, the point is that the life is not being laid down for friends. The life is being laid down because that person has been affirmed in their belief that their life is worthless and of no use, and that they have the right to end it. And you cannot apply this principle to someone in that position who, on top of that basic desire to end their life, then also decides that giving life to others would be a good thing. That is correct. But the desire to take your life is one that should not be, I think, responded to by physicians saying, OK, I'll do it. And I'll stop there and look forward to your questions and comments and clarifications.
Thank you very much, Trevor. We've been listening to Trevor Stammers on organ donation, euthanasia. And thanks very much for that overview, Trevor. We've got a time now for question and answer. So I can see people are already putting their questions into the Q&A. Trevor, With people who already accept euthanasia in principle, what do you think are the best arguments against organ donation euthanasia? So, I mean, as Christians, we would say, there's a line you must cross. You must not intentionally take an innocent human life, even on request, and the end doesn't justify the means. But for people who don't share our belief in human beings being made in the image of God and so on, what do you think are the most powerfully persuasive arguments against organ donation euthanasia?
I think a couple of pragmatic points. I think if you're going to say it's an okay practice, then I think as consent was mentioned as a fundamental concept early on, I don't know how clearly it is put to patients about how the specifics of their death and what happens to them will be carried out. But I would raise questions of, is it fair to say to people, oh, you'll be anaesthetized, and so you won't know any difference from if you received a lethal injection, when in fact they're going to be sedated and transported to a hospital where they may then, and actually, the mechanism of removing the organs and what's done to patients is far from clear in all jurisdictions. But I've certainly, because the death is a circulatory death, read reports of people aspiring to clamp the carotid arteries to starve the brain of oxygen once the procedure is underway to remove the organs to prevent the patient being conscious of it. But even the spelling out of that, I think, if people are made fully aware of what may happen to them, even euthanasia, organ donation aside, I think this needs to be done with circulatory death and brain death in different circumstances. And you've got to be no less scrupulous in these, I think. So that's one element of it that I think is very important, the truthfulness. But the other thing is, I think, that illustrated by Bolland's comment about we mustn't give the impression of an organ hunt. And how can we be certain, particularly with the psychiatrically ill, in a society that accepts that it's okay for the majority of people not to receive treatment, to then be encouraging them possibly to affirm a possible decision to end their lives, as with the girl in the slide, the idea that your worthless life might save others is extremely attractive to the deeply depressed person. And these are arguments that it seems to me, even if you're in favor of euthanasia, you should think twice about this, as with Professor Cohen Albegall.
Yes, that was a chilling example. Was it Heather Janik, I think you said, who talked about her sense of elation about being able to give her organs? And I was struck by the statistics when you said, of all euthanasia, only 1% of it worldwide is done for psychiatric or psychological indications, but
That doesn't.
29% of organ donations involve, people with mental health problems, and at 16 of the 24, it was depression. And so, and yet many patients who have depression and then euthanasia are not getting proper counseling or treatment either. And it seems that there's a very powerful coercive element here that, my life is worthless. It's almost my duty not to hold on to my organs, because there are these other more worthy people who are going to benefit from it, and that I'm doing the right thing by giving up my organs. It's very worryingly coercive, I think.
Yes, the effect on psychiatric practice I'm particularly concerned about. And there was yet another paper in the Journal of Medical Ethics, I think last week, about irremediability of depression treatment not being a contraindication to euthanasia or assisted suicide for depressed patients. And it was arguing that treatment resistant depression, I discovered from that paper, is where somebody's had an adequate dose for an appropriate length of time of just two types of antidepressant. So that seems to me to be a very low bar. But if two haven't worked, you're then treatment resistant, and so that makes you particularly qualifiable for being regarded as suitable for euthanasia once you've allowed it in a country, and those who deny the reality of a slippery slope altogether, I don't know what planet they're living on, frankly, and I think they're beyond reason with.
Yeah. Just coming back to your numbers again, and you talked about the Canadian situation where we've gone from just a few hundred deaths from MAID, or as you pointed out, they're almost all euthanasia anyway, back in 2016, up to over 13,000 a year now. Yeah. And yet you put up another slide which was talking about cases of organ donation euthanasia across a lot of different national context, and the number there was only 267 cases. Now, so the impression is that given the very strong utilitarian arguments for it, why aren't the more cases of organ donation euthanasia happening at the moment? Or do you think they're just not being reported, or is it early days, or what's your take on that?
Now, I'm just going to need to clarify whether we were comparing like with like. So certainly the slide showing 13,000 cases of euthanasia in 2022, that was it then the sequence of the numbers?
That was Canada only, but then you put up a slide which showed the increase of organ donation euthanasia, and that the number at the right end was 267. But I think you said that wasn't just Canada, it was across a number of different countries. And I wondered whether that was the total number worldwide or whether it was just a selection. So, but it just struck me how small the number was compared with the total number, and when it just hasn't caught on yet to the extent that we might fear.
Yes, and I will need to look into that one. I've given the URLs for both of them, and I will get back to you later in the day, because I think that is a key question, and I'm not sure, but I'm not sure that we can be comparing like with like there until I know what the numbers were from Canada.
Okay. Well, let's move on to another question. So Rod McRory is asking, he says, it seems that as soon as you time the death of the donor for the benefit of the recipient, you cannot be acting in the best interests of the donor patient. Is this a legitimate objection?
I would entirely agree with you. Now clearly, if the whole point with my hypothetical example of the depressed patient is that their suffering should not be prolonged. I mean, you'd have a good argument as the patient, let alone somebody making a case against the practice of saying, well, I still want to die today, thank you, whether you've got the recipient or not. And I think this does highlight some of the multi-stranded tensions that there are within this practice, which is why I'm sure that at this moment, corners are being cut in Canada, where it has been going on for a good many years now, and it will explode in a scandal at some point. But as we've seen with other issues, sometimes we had a gross miscarriage of justice that's captured the public imagination just recently. But that that's been around for years and years and years, and it's only just now that it's been highlighted. And I don't want that to poison the whole transplantation system.
Yeah, and you've certainly expressed your concern as being from the perspective of supporting ethical organ donation, that alarm around organ donation euthanasia might have a backlash and have the paradoxical effect of actually reducing the number of transplants that are taking place from live donors or related people. Yeah. And so on.
That's just raised another issue that was a subtext of what I said, but I think is worth making plain, and that's with regard to transparency and consent. If like me, you would not want to receive an organ from someone who had been euthanized, you would have to have some kind of transparency that goes against the usual pattern, which I support, of not letting recipients know too much about the donor. But as soon as you have a large proportion of organs out there, exercising conscientious objection becomes very difficult, both as a potential recipient and as an anaesthetist or someone who works in transplant teams. And that's why essentially denial of exercise of conscientious objection nearly always goes along in states that have introduced euthanasia, and Canada has been one of the most draconian in regard to that. So transplant surgeons leaving their country, if not leaving the profession, is not a scare story. I mean, any scare story about Canada for the opposition is a scare story, isn't it? But that's because they are. At least I find.
Is there any evidence, Trevor, about non-voluntary euthanasia being coupled with organ donation, perhaps in some more authoritarian regimes? What's being written about that? I'm thinking back to a film of 1978 starring Michael Douglas that you might remember, called Coma, where people were bumping folk off in a hospital, rendering them comatose through the misuse of anaesthetic gases, and then procuring their organs for the rich and famous abroad, and there's been talk about street children or prisoners or whatever in various countries. Is there much in that about that in the literature at the moment?
Okay, well, that dates us both the film, but just going back to reality, I saw in the chat that somebody had said that prisoners are not currently allowed to be donors in most countries. Regular attenders at these seminars will know that one of my other major areas of concern is both organ trafficking and forced organ removal. And I personally have no doubt at all that in at least China, despite denials to the contrary, forced organ removals are still being carried out at a substantial level. And the same may well apply in other countries as well. Just recently, the Daily Telegraph in the UK covered a major scandal at the, I guess I can name it since it's in the newspaper article anyway, in the Apollo group of hospitals in India. And if there are any delegates from India who want to comment on that or know anything or say anything about it, please do that in the chat. So in a country where euthanasia is legalized, it probably is a little bit more difficult perhaps to challenge that. I mean, you can say that one is voluntary, the other one isn't. But involuntary euthanasia of the homeless and
prisoners,
in Canada seems to be happening from what I can tell, and nobody in leadership seems to be particularly worried about that.
Just on transparency and truthfulness, Richard Henderson is asking, in countries where it's legal, are potential recipients informed that the donor has been or will be euthanized? I mean, how much information do they get about the source of the organs?
I think that is very, very unlikely, because that's the usual case with organ donation out with the element of euthanasia. If the recipient, like myself, would ask about it, I hope they would get a truthful answer. But it's quite difficult to find the answer to questions like that. The latest report from Canada and from Australia, as far as I know, don't cover that sort of issue, which I agree is very, very important.
Yeah. Now, you made the obvious, I suppose in many ways, the obvious point that the best way of procuring organs which are going to be successful is to take them from young people, and that the most likely young people to donate will be those who are having euthanasia for mental health reasons. And this raises the question about suicide prevention on the one hand and euthanasia. Here we are trying to prevent the suicide of young people with mental health problems on the one hand, and yet on the other, we're saying that they're the best donors. Is a real danger of teenagers with suicidal ideation being actually channeled down this route with a sense of duty that, you know, that they should do it.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought about that in connection with this, and I'm not a huge social media user, but of course many young people are, and I think there are enough ideas of sort of suicide contagion out there for this one perhaps to be a minor player at the moment. But as a general feature, I think the incompatibility of allowing and legalizing assisted suicide and preventing suicide, the evidence overwhelmingly shows that where you introduce it, the total number of suicides, that's to say non-assisted and assisted suicides, generally increases. And my colleague David Jones has just published a paper showing that since they've introduced MAID in Victoria, in Australia, the numbers of suicides in older people have increased.
Yeah, so there's a sense in which it legitimizes suicide, doesn't it? Yeah,
which is intuitively what I would expect, but the other side will deny this categorically and say that it isn't true.
They would say that, wouldn't they? Just finally here, number of people have commented about moves in the UK. There was an article in the Times, Howard Lyons mentions, by Daniel Filkenstein, predicting a new initiative for the legalization of assisted dying by Parliament later this year. And of course, we've got a general election coming up, and the leader of the opposition party was the former officer for public prosecutions, and also a very keen advocate of euthanasia. Do you see a danger in the UK of not just euthanasia, but actually organ donation euthanasia?
I don't think that it is likely that any bill to advocate euthanasia is going to get through here. But as I've said, any bill that allows what's euphemistically called assisted dying will have to have provision for doctors to carry out euthanasia in it. But that will be kept in the small print and, you know, swept under the carpet, and we'll be dismissed as being shroud waivers over that.
Thank you. Well, sadly, we've run out of time. We could keep going on this one, but we're just really grateful to you for bringing us right up to date with this and stimulating our thinking on it and making us aware of the many problems that there are. So it just remains to me to say thanks again, Trevor, and to all of you for joining us today on ICMDA webinars. May the Lord bless you, and we'll see you again in the near future. Thank you.